Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our image of Albert Einstein is of a rumpled but brilliant and endearing character that dramatically reshaped science in the 20th century with his theory of relativity. But we now know that the FBI kept a file on him. In this week's show, we'll find out why and what the agency discovered. We'll also be hearing about conspiracy theories and what makes them so appealing. But before we get to those subjects, Joyce Gidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on April 3, 1936, Bruno Hauptmann was executed for the kidnapping and murder of the infant son of celebrated aviator Charles Lindbergh. In what came to be known as the trial of the century, a cast of characters paraded in the courtrooms and media, capturing the public imagination and bringing the tragedy to life for millions. Charles Lindbergh and his wife, Anne Moreau Lindbergh, were beloved national celebrities, but tragedy struck on the night of March 1, 1932, when someone climbed a ladder to the second-floor nursery of their home, kidnapped their 20-month-old son, and left a ransom note demanding $50,000. Authorities and the press speculated that gangsters had snatched the child, but Al Capone, imprisoned in a Chicago jail, protested, offering $10,000 in reward money for information leading to the arrest of the kidnapper. He even vowed that if he were released from prison, he and his men would find the kidnapper, but he was not released, and the kidnapper increased the ransom to $70,000. John Condon, a family friend, delivered the ransom money, but the baby was not returned. Instead, his battered body was found some 6 weeks later in nearby woods. Police arrested Richard Bruno Hauptmann, a carpenter living in the Bronx, New York. Hauptmann protested his innocence, but the evidence was against him. Police found some of the ransom money in his apartment, and John Condon's phone number scribbled on his closet wall, and Condon identified him as the man to whom he handed the ransom. Hauptmann was found guilty and executed on April 3, 1936.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a new book concludes that J. Robert Oppenheimer, head of the secret laboratory that developed the atom bomb, belonged to the American Communist Party in the late 1930s and early 1940s. Contrary to his repeated denials, Oppenheimer belonged to a cell of the party that discouraged members from disclosing their membership, writes Greg Herkin in his book Brotherhood of the Bomb, The Tangled Lives and Loyalties of Robert Oppenheimer, Ernest Lawrence, and Edward Teller. Herkin rests his case on newly discovered letters, Oppenheimer's reaction to work on an accusatory memoir, and the discovery of communist literature that the author links to Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer, who died in 1967, acknowledged that he had joined many related organizations in the 1930s, but he denied ever having joined the Communist Party itself. The issue arose in 1954, when federal hearings led to the revocation of Oppenheimer's security clearance and his removal from the nation's atomic weapons program. This is Talking History. From our reading of a new book by our guest, Fred Jerome, it becomes clear that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had a decidedly different view of Albert Einstein than most Americans. Indeed, Hoover kept a file on the scientist, and that is the subject of this week's conversation between Fred Jerome and Creighton University historian Eileen Dugan.
One of my professors once remarked that it's hard to find a really bad photograph of Albert Einstein. And it's true. In picture after picture, he comes across as a deep thinker, a stereotypical professor, and everyone's favorite uncle. It's hard not to find something rather endearing in his rumpled clothes, his wild mane of hair, and those eyes that seem forever searching, forever dreaming. That is the image we have of Einstein, warm and wise and totally harmless. So to many of us, it would be shocking to learn that the FBI maintained a file on him. What could he have possibly done to deserve that? With us today to answer that question is journalist Fred Jerome, author of The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist. Welcome, Mr. Jerome.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why did you undertake studying this file on Einstein?
Well, actually, it was an accident. I was researching another story. I was researching a story on what the most widely covered science news stories were in the 20th century. And I come to the conclusion that Einstein himself was the most widely covered news story, and because everybody knew about him. And I stumbled onto this little piece in the Times in 1983, and page 17 of section 4, right next to the weather map, that said something about the FBI having filed reports on Einstein. Four paragraphs. And I thought, that's interesting. And nobody knows about that. That would make an interesting news magazine story or a book, possibly even a book. So I decided to pursue it, and I discovered that not only does everybody know about Einstein, but nobody knows about Einstein.
So what sources did you use, and how was it obtaining these materials?
Well, I first went to see the professor in Florida who had gotten the FBI's file on Einstein released back in 1983, and he had spent 3 years getting it released, 3 years of Freedom of Information Act requests. And he, Richard Allen Schwartz, was very friendly and gave me his copy, and I looked through it and then found it fascinating and started to put together a book. But I also realized that about at least 30% of it had been withheld or blacked out by the FBI. So I went to the Public Citizen Litigation Group in Washington, which is a Nader spinoff legal group, and they agreed to represent me for nothing, which was about what I could afford, and get the attempt to get the rest of the file from the FBI. And it took them 2 years, but they finally did. And so I now have virtually the entire FBI file. There are still some pages being withheld that they're still trying to get and having a difficult time. But I have almost all of it. I also, in the process, went to former FBI agents, and each one led me to another one, and I went to as many as I could. Some were friendly. Most of them were quite willing to talk. Some were friendly to Hoover, and some were not. And a few refused to talk. Some would give their names, and some talked only if I left their names out. But each one led to another one, and it was fascinating.
So when you brought these materials together and began to write a book and produce this book, what makes you think that this book is, so to speak, yet another book on Einstein?
Well, what I discovered really is, with three stories, if I can divide it up somewhat, three stories, all of which were virtually unknown by the American public and maybe the world's public. And I should say one thing before I get to the three stories, and that is that I also discovered that under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI had security files on 10 million Americans, which is a huge number and a shocking number. And yet, in fact, the fact that they had a file on Einstein and were out to get Einstein dramatizes that fact perhaps more than anything else in people's minds. It's sort of shocking that they really went after Einstein. So I'd just like to remind people, keep that number, 10 million, in mind when we talk about Einstein, because he was far from being alone. The three stories are this. First of all, we now know, the FBI's file makes it very clear, that from 1933, the year Einstein moved to America, until his death in 1955, the FBI amassed 1,800 pages of, quote, derogatory information on Einstein in a campaign that included spying, or what we now call dirty tricks, tapping Einstein's phone, opening his mail, that's called a mail cover, and searching his trash, which in FBI ease is called a trash watch, and even breaking into the home of his secretary's nephew. And the campaign included, contrary to general belief, barring Einstein from working on the atomic bomb, even though he proposed building it in his famous letter to Roosevelt. And even, incredible as it may seem, a secret project aimed at deporting him from America as an undesirable alien. So that was the first story, that happened. The second story is the story behind the story, the reason for Hoover's anti-Einstein campaign, and that was because Einstein was actually quite political, again, quite the opposite of the image which you've already described. He said often, my life is divided between equations and politics. And while equations were clearly number one in his life, he spent a lot of time on second place. And he was involved in numerous organizations and campaigns for social justice and civil rights. In 1946, if I can just name one, he was co-chairman with Paul Robeson of the American Campaign to End Lynching, American Crusade to End Lynching. And they organized a demonstration at Washington, in Washington, had a confrontation with President Truman demanding anti-lynching legislation. Einstein wasn't actually at, couldn't actually make the Washington demonstration, but he sent a letter to Truman, which Robeson and the other leaders carried with them when they went. In 1953, he publicly urged witnesses to refuse to answer questions from the McCarthy Committee and the House on American Activities Committee and other congressional inquisitions, as he called them. And so that, and those are just some of many of the things that he did, and he was anti-militarist, and just about every aspect of Einstein's political outlook, political dimension, ran counter to Hoover's ultra-right-wing grain. Just the third story, which I won't, is very brief, but it's really why nobody knows about the first two stories, why we have this ongoing image of kindly, absent-minded, bumbling old man, and we haven't been told, for the most part, any of the first two stories.
How did Americans react when Einstein first came to live in the United States?
Well, for the most part, he was greeted with great enthusiasm. He became very popular. He was the, many people consider him the most popular refugee in America, refugee from Nazism, which is what he was. He had been here before. He had traveled around the country before, and he'd always been very popular. There was, however, a small group of sort of right-wing fanatics called the Woman Patriot Corporation, something like the Daughters of the American Revolution, who were very well-endowed financially, ladies connected to bankers and businessmen, mostly in New York and Boston, who took it upon themselves to try to save America from the infiltration of alien elements. And Einstein was number one on their list, and they issued a 16-page, single-spaced, legal-sized typed document, which they sent to the State Department, denouncing Einstein as everything from an anarchist to a communist to a traitor who was planning to shoot the generals in the American army, all undocumented, of course. This document is the first 16 pages in the FBI's 1,800-page file on Einstein.
When did the FBI really begin keeping track of Einstein?
Well, it really began in a sporadic way as soon as he got here. I mean, that document was in 1932, and he got here in 33, and various offices collected little things on him. If he would make a speech, for example, supporting the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War, the anti-fascist, anti-Franco side, that would go in one of his files in some city and so on and so forth. But in 1940, when the Army started putting together the lists of scientists who would work on the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project, it was then that they asked Hoover for to give them Einstein's file, and it was based on that file that Army G2 refused to grant Einstein clearance, and therefore he was denied the ability to work on the atomic bomb. He was cleared by the Navy, ironically, and did some more work for the Navy at the same time. But the denial of clearance to Einstein by the Army was something that was not widely known, and for a long time it was sort of a mystery. Why, here was a man who proposed the bomb to Roosevelt, why wasn't he working on it? But in any case, it got even more intense. I would say a full-scale Einstein, Get Einstein campaign wasn't launched by J. Edgar Hoover until 1950, which was also the beginning of the McCarthy period and coincided with McCarthy's speech about how there's so many Reds in the State Department, and it coincided with the sort of spy fever that was sweeping America with the arrest of Klaus Fuchs as a spy in London, and a whole bunch of other people in this country. And so for 5 years, from 1950 to 1955, Hoover coordinated a centralized campaign to get Einstein, which he collected information from every FBI office and Army intelligence offices in Europe, all attempting to show not only that Einstein belonged to many left-leaning organizations, which he was happy to show. He did that all very publicly. But to try to show that Einstein had espionage connections and that had some links to Soviet espionage, that would have been, if Hoover could have succeeded in showing that, he might have been able to go public with his investigation, which otherwise he kept very secret, because it would have been very embarrassing to him and to the FBI and to the whole world if it had come out that he was investigating the world's greatest scientist, America's most famous refugee, and so on and so forth. So he kept it under tight wraps. And if he had found espionage evidence, I think he might have then gone public with it.
What kinds of evidence, true or not, were they able to get on Einstein?
Well, of course, there were two types of evidence, really. The first type were the political evidence. That is, he belonged to some 70 organizations, such as the American Crusade to End Lynching, the Committee to Save Willie McGee, a black Mississippian who was lynched after 12 years of campaigning to save his life on a phony rape charge. A number of organizations like that, and he also belonged to organizations supporting the veterans of the Lincoln Brigade, that is the Americans who fought in Spain, many organizations that supported immigrants to this country and immigrants' rights, and so on. All of that he did publicly, and so the FBI easily collected that evidence. I mean, they could have hired a clipping service and gotten that evidence, but they had their secret agents go out and send in news clippings and flyers. Anyway, that evidence Hoover was not eager to make public, because Einstein and the organizations he belonged to all wanted it made public. That was the idea. Einstein was lending his scientific prestige to the cause of his moral indignation, as one historian put it, and the more people who knew about that, the better. So Hoover was not eager to make that public, although it fills up a good deal of the FBI file, because that's what the FBI did. They kept track of all these things. The other part of the evidence had to do with alleged espionage connections. And Hoover found half a dozen or so people who charged that Einstein was connected to various Soviet spies, starting with Klaus Fuchs and then going on to a spy ring that existed in Germany in 1929, from 1929 to 1932, going that far back, which allegedly received Russian cables from the Far East and in code, and then translated them and transmitted them to Moscow. And Einstein's house was supposedly a part of that with Einstein's knowledge. So I won't tell you the whole story, because I don't want to give away the ending, but Hoover really did pursue that with great diligence for 5 years. And it was partly because of that the Immigration Naturalization Service thought they might first denaturalize and then deport Einstein.
We only have a few moments left, but the question arises, what relevance do you think the story of the Einstein file, what relevance do you think this has today? I mean, because, Hoover's dead, Einstein's dead, Cold War's over.
Well, what the thing is that that story's about really is not just Hoover versus Einstein. It's about a clash of cultures, the culture that Einstein represented of challenge and change, versus the culture of obedience that Hoover represented. And that clash between those two cultures is still going on today. I think today we see, if J. Edgar Hoover were the head of the search committee for his successor, I think he couldn't have come up with anybody better than Ashcroft. And I think there's little doubt that if Einstein were alive today, that he would be high on Ashcroft's list, just as he was high on Hoover's list. He would be out protesting against the proposal for a Homeland Security Department and the citizen spy squads made up of mailmen and utility workers and anyone else who wants to turn in a neighbor. And it seems to me that more than that, however, one of the most important single things that I learned from this book, and I think people can learn from this book, Einstein's legacy to us outside of physics is that you can, and he probably would say must, resist government repression. That he actually did. He told people not to go along with McCarthyism, not to go along in some cases with the draft if they didn't think that was right, to stand up and say no. And he did it successfully, and he encouraged other people to do it. And his whole point was that you have to be prepared to save the democratic principles that we value, that we cherish so much and are so often used to justify war and repression. But if you really want to save them, you have to be prepared to resist and even in some cases to go to jail to defend them.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid that's all the time we have, Mr. Jerome.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. We have been talking with Fred Jerome, author of The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist.
Following up on our interview with Fred Jerome, we thought we would tell you about a museum exhibit where you can learn more about Albert Einstein. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
In 1933, Frank Wall of Queens, New York, wrote to Albert Einstein, tongue-in-cheek perhaps, to ask the great physicist if he thought that gravity could cause someone to do foolish things, like fall in love. Falling in love is not at all the most stupid thing that people do, Einstein wrote back, but gravitation cannot be held responsible for it. The letter is part of a new exhibit on Einstein's life and legacy at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. The exhibit merges the personal with the scientific, bringing together science fiction-like special effects with original manuscripts never before seen in this country. The boldest goal of the exhibit is to attempt to explain Einstein's theory of relativity to the general public. Einstein's theory may seem exotic, the exhibit organizers note, but it explains how we see and respond to the world around us. The exhibit will remain at the American Museum of National History until August.
People often emotionally reject the grim truth that tragedies can just happen. They cast about for other explanations and often for someone to blame. So concludes our guest commentator this week, Don B. Cates, in his Ruminations on Conspiracy Theories.
The idea that JFK was killed by some faceless, nameless government conspirators is just another one of the paranoid fantasies that appear throughout history. The actual assassin was Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone. He brought a long paper bag to work that day, saying it contained curtain rods. None were found. Instead, his rifle was found, with his palm prints on it and fibers from his shirt and from the blanket he stored the rifle in. Nearby was his clipboard, with none of his work orders filled. Oswald lied about his whereabouts during the shooting. He said he was eating lunch with a co-employee, but neither that man nor those he actually ate with saw Oswald. To think Oswald a conspirator is to ignore his whole life. This bumbling misfit and loner had never managed to cooperate with anyone about anything. Even the political committee he created had only one member, him. In the months before the assassination, he had no visitors in the rooming house where he lived, and his only phone calls were with his wife, who lived elsewhere. As for Oswald being a patsy, he was so erratic no sensible conspirators would have picked him for that role. He could not be counted on to even show up at work that day, or to stay there rather than wandering off somewhere else where witnesses would have seen him during the shooting. If Oswald was not the shooter, where was he? How did conspirators manage to have him seen at work right before and after the shooting, but disappear during it? Not only is there no evidence of shooters from multiple directions, it makes no sense. If there had been a conspiracy to blame Oswald alone, it obviously would not involve shooters from multiple directions. Finally, the idea that the military killed JFK to keep him from withdrawing from Vietnam is just a 1960s peacenik fantasy. JFK was a conservative Democrat elected on a platform of military preparedness who spent billions on the military. We were in Vietnam because JFK put us there, and Oswald shot him on his way to make a speech reaffirming his intent to stay. Conspiracy fantasies are timeless. 300 years ago, Englishmen thought French Catholic conspirators had started the Great Fire of 1666. They actually lynched some Frenchmen in London who turned out to be Protestants who had fled from Catholic persecution in France. In the 1940s, some Americans thought Franklin Roosevelt and his staff conspired to let the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor in order to get us into World War II. Today, some nuts claim AIDS was invented by American scientists to kill blacks, while other nuts say Israel, not Osama, was behind the 9/11 attack. Next, will we hear that the Israeli on board the Columbia mission sabotaged the Columbia? For more information, I recommend the excellent book Case Closed by Gerald Posner.
You've been listening to Don B. Cates, a constitutional lawyer and criminologist and the co-author of Armed, New Perspectives on Gun Control. Cates has gathered much more information on conspiracy theories at his website, doncates.com. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that's it for another week of Talking History. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. And this is your host, Brian Laveau, reminding you that you can learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians at oah.org. Have a good week.